From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Thai Prime Minister is removed by the Constitutional Court. Voters crowd polling booths for South Africa's election. The U.S. warns of taking a bigger bite from Russia's economy over Ukraine. And some teenagers living extraordinary lives to make a difference.
The biggest thing for kids and adults is to never let age and gender be a barrier, and to not just dream, but to dream big.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Thailand's Constitutional Court has ruled the country's caretaker prime minister and some of her cabinet must step down for abuse of power. This comes after months of political deadlock and renews concerns of the possibility of violence between supporters and opponents of the government. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
The Constitutional Court ruled Ms. Yingluck Shinawat and members of her cabinet abused their authority when they transferred a National Security Council official, which paved the way for her relative to become the National Police Chief. Presiding Judge Charun Intachan read the final part of the lengthy verdict which removed the Prime Minister. The judge says that in accordance with the Constitution, the Premiership is now declared vacant. He adds that all nine surviving members of the Cabinet, when the unlawful personnel transfer was made in 2011, must also step down. The remaining members of the Cabinet quickly selected from among themselves the interim Commerce Minister, Nuattamrong Bunsong Paisan, as the new caretaker prime minister. Shortly after that announcement, Ms. Yingluck made a televised speech thanking the people for their trust and support in difficult times. The outgoing caretaker prime minister says, despite the court ruling, she did not violate the law. Her governing Piao Thai party calls the Constitutional Court's verdict a conspiracy to try to destroy democracy. A former foreign minister, Napadong Patama, who is a supporter of the current government, contends the court decision is unconstitutional, but says it is likely to be accepted.
The prime minister has done nothing wrong, but the court ruled against the prime minister. What I'm surprised is that the court didn't disqualify the whole cabinet, which is good.
Chulalongkorn University political science professor Thitinan Pongsudhirak agrees that leaving in place 25 members of the cabinet provides some short-term stability.
I am cautiously optimistic, while I've been pessimistic all along. This time, the Constitutional Court did not go all the way. They went almost all the way. They got rid of Yingluck, got rid of the cabinet from 3 years ago, but they left some cabinet members behind to succeed Yingluck and to run a caretaker administration. This means that we have a chance to get to the election day.
This is the third time Thailand's courts have removed a prime minister since 2006. All three represented parties backed by Thaksin Shinawat, Ms. Yingluck's elder brother, who remains the main backer of the Pheo Thai party. Thailand's Election Commission has called for a new nationwide ballot on July 20th. The government has rejected a proposal by an opposition leader to delay the vote 6 months to put in place political and electoral reforms, leaving the election date in doubt. The head of the group of protesters who occupied parts of Bangkok for months says an unelected People's Council should run the country for an indefinite period to put in place reforms that prevent election rigging. Government supporters have contended the real reason the Democrats and allied groups oppose elections is because they know the majority of the electorate will not vote for them. The judicial ouster of the prime minister angers longtime core supporters of the Shinawat family. Tens of thousands of so-called red shirts, popular among the rural population in the northern part of the country, are expected to begin moving towards the capital for a mass rally here Saturday, according to protest organizers. That could lead to clashes on the streets with the yellow shirts and other anti-government elements. Former Foreign Minister Napadong is hopeful that the red shirts will not provoke any violence.
We have to prevent any possible clash with our opponent. Otherwise, the clash or the violence would be cited as an excuse to stage a military coup or for any uncalled for military intervention.
Since Thailand's 1932 revolution, nine prime ministers have been kicked out by military coups. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
South Africans turned out in large numbers today to vote in the nation's fifth democratic elections. Analysts say the ruling party will cruise to an easy win. Despite the growing cynicism that has tinged the campaign, voters in Johannesburg said they were proud and thrilled to participate. VOA's Anita Powell spoke with voters about their feelings on this important day.
Like millions of his fellow South Africans, Zohib Khan woke up early on Wednesday to cast his vote. He and his sister arrived at their Johannesburg polling station before it opened at 7 a.m. and waited for more than an hour. There was just one little problem. Khan still hadn't decided who to vote for.
I have back and forth a lot. I haven't made the final decision yet.
Now, I must note we're standing about 50 meters away from the polling booth.
Running out of time. Yeah. Party I've traditionally voted for has let me down a bit, so I think there's only one other viable option, but I don't like them either, so it's complicated.
Khan, who is a 28-year-old academic researcher, is part of an emerging demographic in this election, which comes 20 years after South Africa ended apartheid and became a democracy. Many South Africans say the party they've long supported, the ruling African National Congress, has failed to address long-standing inequality and provide basic services, and has been hurt by multiple corruption scandals. But many also point to a weak and untested opposition whose political foibles make them difficult to support. Bakan's sister Jahara says she wouldn't let his indecision cut into her excitement to vote for the first time. She is 18 and a member of the so-called Born Free generation, born after 1994.
Yes, very excited. Well, generally, I want to vote for a party that'll do the most good in South Africa, because right now I don't think we're in a very good place, so I want to vote for a party that'll definitely make a difference.
The usually packed streets of Johannesburg were nearly empty Wednesday. Finding polling stations became very easy. Just follow any car on the road to end up at a polling station thronged with a diverse crowd. At several stations, the mood was jubilant, with voters bringing family members, pets, and children. Some voters donned the rainbow colors of South Africa's flag or wore gear from national sports teams. The ANC is predicted to win with 63% of the vote. For many voters, like 28-year-old Millie Sizwe Notwala, the decision to support the ANC is an emotional one. The ANC was banned under apartheid, and many South Africans suffered for supporting them.
It's a matter of loyalty. I know exactly where I'm coming from, the sacrifice that was paid for where I am today. So I will just go there and do the right thing for my family, as well as for my children as well.
Maria Matlalias, 54, has voted in all five elections since she was granted voting rights in 1994. She said she used to support the ANC, but no longer.
I want to change because the other one we was voting for here is not good for us. Now we have to change to vote another party to get something like water, electricity, better life.
But Gracia Morarora, also 54, says she's giving the ruling party one more chance. She says she's seen few fruits of South Africa's development. She was denied government-subsidized housing and still uses an outdoor toilet in her home just outside Johannesburg.
For 5 years, if nothing changes, if I'm still alive, then I'm not going to vote. I promise I'm not going to vote because it won't help me to vote.
This election perhaps has shown a new facet of the Rainbow Nation, a country not just of different races, as the term originally intended, but of people with wildly differing views, who believe their differences should never again force them apart. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Nigerian police are offering a $300,000 reward to help the search for 276 missing schoolgirls kidnapped by militants last month. The leader of Islamist militant group Boko Haram claims responsibility for the kidnapping and says the group intends to sell them. Here in Washington, President Obama spoke about U.S. help for Nigeria as they attempt to find the girls.
We've already sent in a team to Nigeria. They've accepted our help, a combination of military, law enforcement, and other agencies who are going in, trying to identify where, in fact, these girls might be, and to provide them help. Obviously, it's a heartbreaking situation, outrageous situation. You've got one of the worst regional or local terrorist organizations in Boko Haram in Nigeria. They've been killing people ruthlessly for many years now, and we've already been seeking greater cooperation with the Nigerians. This may be the event that helps to mobilize the entire international community to finally do something against this horrendous organization that's perpetrated such a terrible crime.
In Britain, Foreign Secretary William Hague commented on the situation in Nigeria.
What has happened here, that the actions of Boko Haram in using girls as the spoils of war, the spoils of terrorism, is disgusting, it is immoral. It should show everybody across the world that they should not give any support to such a vile organization.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says he has ordered his top security officials to do all they could to secure the kidnapped girls' release.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says if Russia interferes with Ukraine's May 25th presidential election, the United States will impose more sanctions that he says will take a bigger bite out of the Russian economy. Meeting in Washington with European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton Tuesday, Kerry said the U.S. is not going to sit idly by while Russia fans the flames of instability. He said sanctions so far have had a major impact on Russia's struggling economy and that the U.S. and its allies have only begun. Ashton called the May 25th presidential election in Ukraine a really important step towards stabilization. She said the Ukrainian people will decide what Ukraine is and what it will be. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the legitimacy of the election is in doubt because of the Ukrainian military action in the east against pro-Russian separatists. Kerry dismissed that and said the right of the Ukrainian people to decide their own future is a universal value respected around the world. He said any more referendums that would split parts of Ukraine to join Russia would be bogus and unrecognized by all civilized nations. Meanwhile, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs Victoria Nuland testified on Capitol Hill, where a growing bipartisan chorus is urging tougher penalties against Russia. VOA's Michael Bowman has details.
Patience with President Barack Obama's step-by-step approach to sanctioning Moscow is growing thin in Congress. The top Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, says U.S. measures targeting Russian President Vladimir Putin's inner circle have had zero impact on Moscow.
Since the sanctions went in place last Monday, the stock market has risen almost 4% in Russia. They're laughing it off. It has no effect whatsoever on Russia's behavior.
Not so, according to Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland.
Senator, I would disagree with you with regard to the impact of sanctions. Russia's economy is already showing that this model does not lead to a great Russia. It leads to a broke one. Russia's credit rating is hovering just above junk. $51 billion in capital has fled Russia since the beginning of the year.
Corker is one of several Republicans urging sanctions on Russian banks and other economic sectors, something President Obama has not ruled out if the crisis in Ukraine intensifies. At Tuesday's hearing, Corker repeatedly asked why such measures are not being imposed preemptively to deter further aggression by Moscow. Nuland responded that the administration is preparing tougher sanctions in coordination with America's NATO allies. She did not say when or under what circumstances those measures would be imposed. Republican lawmakers are not alone in calling for a more vigorous U.S. response to the crisis in Ukraine. Committee Chairman Robert Menendez, a Democrat, urged military reinforcements for NATO states in Central and Eastern Europe and tougher sanctions readied against Russia.
I'm not shy when it comes to the use of sanctions because I believe they can be an effective tool of peaceful diplomacy, whether against Iran or Russian oligarchs who have made Moscow the home of more billionaires than anywhere else in the world.
Menendez added that assistance to Ukraine should be expedited, including providing Kyiv with U.S. military equipment such as body armor. Later in the day, the entire Senate met behind closed doors to discuss the crisis in Ukraine and America's response. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Ukrainian officials Tuesday voiced support for a new round of international negotiations to find a peaceful resolution to the growing conflict with pro-Russian separatists in the eastern part of the country. But VOA's Brian Patton reports officials in Kyiv rejected Russia's latest proposal that pro-Russian rebels also be included in the talks.
Despite the expanding military conflict between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian separatists and the escalating war of words between Russia and the West, diplomacy can still work. That is what Danilo Lubkivsky, Ukraine's deputy foreign minister, thinks. And he says a clear example of this was the negotiated release of observers with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe who were held by separatists in eastern Ukraine.
It was a good result of coordinated plan and efforts of Ukrainian authority, OSCE mission, and all international mediators involved. That's actually a clear example how the Geneva agreements can work and should be implemented if there is a strong political will.
Ukraine questions Russia's support for any real peace plan and has accused Moscow of supporting separatists in an attempt to destabilize the country in advance of the planned May 25th presidential elections. Russia has denied the allegations and says it is Kiev and the West that have acted in a provocative manner and alienated Russian-speaking Ukrainians. Deputy Foreign Minister Lubkivsky says Ukraine supports further negotiations with Russia and Western partners to resolve the current crisis. He says Ukraine is adhering to the Geneva Agreement reached in April, which called for ending all private armed militias and for protesters to leave occupied buildings. The separatists in eastern Ukraine refused to comply with this agreement. They say the Kiev government continues to allow Right Sector, the pro-Ukrainian militia, to operate freely and allow nationalist protesters to occupy Maidan Square in the capital. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says any new international negotiations should include pro-Russian rebels. Mr. Lubkivsky says Ukraine is open to increased dialogue or a national unity forum that would include all regions of Ukraine. However, he says Ukraine draws the line at negotiating with armed separatists who he calls terrorists.
Let us not mix two things, terrorism and national dialogue. We will fight against terrorism. And we will ensure national dialogue in this country.
As diplomats meet in Europe to discuss this crisis, Ukraine's military forces continue to surround separatist strongholds in the eastern part of the country. Ukraine's security service said Tuesday the government is reluctant to attack militants in highly populated areas due to the likelihood of civilian casualties. Brian Patton, VOA News, Kiev.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
A new study finds maternal deaths due to complications in pregnancy and childbirth have been cut nearly in half since 1990. But the World Health Organization says most countries will not meet the 2015 Millennium Development Goal of reducing maternal deaths by two-thirds. WHO Director of Reproductive Health and Research, Marlene Timmerman, is co-author of the study.
If you look at what is the lifetime risk for a woman, for a girl to die during pregnancy and childbirth, then it is 1 in 40 in sub-Saharan Africa as compared to 1 in 3,500 approximately in, for example, Europe or the Western world.
The World Health Organization says steady progress in reducing maternal deaths is being made, but it says there has been too little progress in preventing adolescent pregnancies, abortions, maternal deaths, sexually transmitted infections, and HIV in the last 20 years. The report says 10 countries account for about 60% of global maternal deaths. They include India, Nigeria, Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Indonesia, Pakistan, Tanzania, Kenya, China, and Uganda. While most teenagers in the United States spend their time juggling school, home, and friends, there are few who are choosing a different light. They are charting their own path to make a difference in the world. Elizabeth Lee met three of them in Los Angeles, California, where they recently gathered to talk about their work and what makes them unique.
15-year-old Winter Vanecki has accomplished more than most people have in a lifetime.
I recently completed a marathon on all seven continents and became the youngest person in the world to do so. And I really was doing this for my dad.
Vanecki's father was diagnosed with a rare and aggressive form of prostate cancer when she was 9. He died 10 months later.
When he was first diagnosed, I immediately knew I had to do something to help him. That's when I formed Team Winter for prostate cancer research and awareness.
Through Team Winter and social media, Vanecki has raised close to $500,000. From Kenya to Mongolia, she has taken prostate cancer awareness worldwide through her seven continent marathons.
So prostate cancer is much more common, but the men don't want to talk about it.
In the U.S., she travels constantly to give talks about prostate cancer and inspire others. At the recent Milken Institute Global Conference in Los Angeles, Vanecki was one of several teenagers who addressed a panel about youth who are living extraordinary lives.
85% of all pancreatic cancers are diagnosed late.
Another panelist was Jack Andreka, who invented an inexpensive sensor for pancreatic, ovarian, and lung cancers when he was 15.
Without Google and Wikipedia, I would have never been able to learn all the stuff I needed for this project. I mean, I didn't even know what pancreas was before developing my test for pancreatic cancer.
He is currently filing patents for his latest inventions, inexpensive water quality devices that help detect and filter out heavy metals and pesticides.
I hope to see them employed in the developing nations such as Bangladesh and parts of China and India, especially as well as in parts of Africa, where these heavy metal and pesticide and other industrial effluents are a major problem.
16-year-old activist Mary Pat Hector saw a problem in her own community. She says too many youth die from gun violence.
It was seeing my friends hurt. It was seeing it on the television constantly. It kind of made me feel like I had to do something about it.
She became the national youth director of one of the largest civil rights organizations in the United States, the National Action Network. She also started a campaign which educates youth on the issue of gun violence.
My 8-year-old brother drives me. You know, I think about how innocent he is, and I just want the world to be a better place for him and my children.
Mary Pat Hector, Jack Andreka, and Winter Vanecki say a combination of supportive parents, the internet, and social media have helped them succeed. But what's most important comes from within, says Winter Vanecki and Jack Andreka.
I think the biggest thing for kids and adults is to never let age and gender be a barrier, and to not just dream, but to dream big.
Never let anyone else tell you no. Always keep going for your dream and think if a 15-year-old could do it, just think what you could do.
They say with that kind of thinking, anything is possible. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
The number of internet users worldwide continues to rise, according to the United Nations Telecommunications Agency, which says there will be almost 3 billion users by the end of this year. 2/3 of those users will be in developing countries. In a statement, the International Telecommunication Union, or ITU, also says the number of mobile cellular subscriptions will be even higher, reaching almost 7 billion by the end of 2014. At the same time, the number of fixed telephone subscribers continues to fall, with the ITU predicting there will be 100 million fewer landlines this year than in 2009. The developing world is pushing up the number of mobile cellular subscriptions, mostly in the Asia-Pacific region, but the ITU says the global growth rate of 2.6% indicates that cellular phone markets may be reaching its peaks. The ITU predicts that by the end of this year, 44% of households worldwide will have internet access. It says nearly 1/3 of the households in developing nations will have an internet connection, compared with 78% in the developed world. The agency's statistics are considered to be the most reliable and impartial and are used by many government agencies and private companies. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day by visiting our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. Come on by. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.